Verses 6 through 10 may seem a little bit out of place. You know, there in the first part of the chapter, you've got this angel that comes and brings this charge against the Israelites. And then all of a sudden, after this angel makes this charge against God's people, the author then proceeds to talk a little bit about Joshua and about the generation following Joshua and then the generation that arose after the death of Joshua. And you may wonder, well, why are we talking about Joshua here? One of the things we'll quickly find out, and you're going to be reminded, I'll be saying this repeatedly throughout the course of the study of the book of Judges, the book itself was not written chronologically. And so what we have here the author is doing, he's taking us back to the days of Joshua to kind of set the stage and set the context of what he's going to be saying in verse 11. And it's going to bring everyone to an understanding of why when we read verse 11, we see that the sons of Israel are going after the Baals. He's helping us understand why it is that was. If you go back to Judges 1:1, you find out that it starts off with the death of Joshua, but you've got the author bringing it up here again in chapter 2, verse 6. And so he just kind of reminds the people and helps the reader understand this is the result, this is the reason that these people, God's people, have gone off after various idols. You read verses 5 and 11, you kind of get a sense of chronologically the order that things are happening. You see in verse 5, they named the place Bochim. They sacrificed to the Lord. That's the Israelites. And then you go on straight to verse 11. You take this a positive of verses 6 through 10 out, and you see that after they offered the sacrifice to the Lord, the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And so chapter 2, verses 6 through 10 help us understand why it was the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. Because this generation came up that did not know God, and then they as in turn fall into this pattern of idolatry. Now, I know I've spoken on several occasions in this class and in other classes as well, the importance of good leadership, but I think we need to stop and we need to reiterate that again just because of the frequency with which the Bible does so. And so maybe you could say it's a soapbox of mine. I'm just trying to follow the pattern of thought that I see here in the Bible. But as we see, you can chase through Israel's history. As the leader goes, the people do as well. If the leader is moral, if the judge is moral, if the king is moral, then the people have a tendency to fall in line with the morality and the spirituality of the leader. And if they get a bad leader that's immoral and wicked, then the people oftentimes go following the king's behavior. You can go and you can look at Israel's history. Israel was constantly worshiping idols, constantly in disfavor with God. They never had a single good king. However, you look at the nation under the days of David. David was a good king. He steered the people toward righteousness, and the people kind of fell in line with his behaviors, with his morality and his faithfulness to God. And so it becomes very obvious, as the leader goes, so goes the people very often. Now, we stop and we think we're a very critical time in our country, and there's ultimately, just honestly, there's not going to be a very moral leader, regardless of who is elected in our country. And I was talking to Whitney this morning as I was kind of reviewing for the class, and I said, that's frightful to me. That's fearful to me. Because whichever direction this country chooses to go based off of the next leader that we elect, if we, as we've seen Israel do and as we've seen other nations do, where the people fall in line with the morality of the leader, either way, you're going to end up with the people that are probably going further and further and further away from God. I know we focus a lot of our attention, we focus a lot of our time talking about what can we do as individuals to make a difference, perhaps in the leadership of this country. We may think, well, one of the most important things we can do is we can vote. And by doing so, we can not only express, but we can make a statement for where it is that we stand, perhaps the candidate that we stand for, perhaps the policies and the things that we want to see implemented and then trickle down throughout this country. And so we place a lot of emphasis on that particular action. But let me say there's something so much greater, and especially parents. Grandparents will have some effect as well, but especially parents who are in the position where they're raising children, there's something so much more effective that you can do to better this world in which we live, to bring people closer to God, than expressing your opinion for who should be president and the laws that should come into effect. And that is just simply bringing up faithful children, training them as we're going to see here. I think we're going to see the failing of Israel they did not have a good leader. A point in time arose where they did not have a good leader. And so for the church to continue, for the church to remain strong, you look at leadership of churches, it follows into that same pattern as well. You look at leadership in families, that follows into that same pattern as well. If the church is the leaders of the church are weak and they don't address the issues and they just bury their heads in the ground and let problems go unaddressed, then the congregation is going to be full of problems. And people will be imitating the same sort of behaviors. You look at parents and how they lead in the home for their children that they bring up. And oftentimes you see children are nothing more than just a pattern of what their parents were when they were raising them up. And so they take on their characteristics of morality and faithfulness or faithlessness. And so the most single important thing that we can do if we want to make a difference in this world, it's not going to be done in the voting booth. It's going to be done in the children that we bring up. And that's why leadership is so significant. It's significant because it's going to affect the type of Christians that are going to come as a result of this generation that's raising children. It's going to affect the church because at some point in time, the leaders of the congregation now, that while they may be strong, there may come a time where others have to step into their place and they haven't been properly brought up, properly trained and molded to step into that role of leadership. And if they're not prepared to do so, then which direction is the church going to go? What impact is that going to have on the church? What impact is that going to have on the home? And so the importance of good leadership in the home, in the church, in the country, anywhere you look at leadership, it's of the utmost importance because of the authority and influence that's there. Moses understood that. I was reading in Deuteronomy in my daily reading. And one of the things, whenever God comes to Moses and he says, Moses, you're soon going to die. You're soon going to see the promised land and you're going to be buried at the top of Mount Nebo after you die. And Moses, rather than making any sort of statement about asking for more life or this, that, or the other, he says, Lord, these people need a leader. And he prays to God. He says, without a leader, they're going to be like sheep without a shepherd. And so he prays to God. God says, okay, here's what you're to do. You're to take Joshua. And you'll remember, Joshua was referred to as the servant of Moses. He's been with Moses when Moses went up on the mountain to receive the law of God. He's followed Moses around. He's shadowed him around. He knows how Moses leads. The characteristics and leadership qualities of Moses have trickled down to Joshua. God says, you take Joshua. You lay your hands on him in front of the people. And he was going to be the next leader appointed by God for the children of Israel. And as we read through this text, we see in verse 7 that the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua, who was the next leader that followed in the footsteps of Moses. So it's interesting, though, as we continue reading in this text, that although during the generation of Joshua and the generation that followed Joshua, the elders whom Joshua no doubt influenced because of his good leadership, after them there arose a generation that did not know God. And so, whether it was a failing on Joshua's part to ask for God to appoint a leader, because he understood that without a good leader, Israel was going to end up going astray, I wouldn't necessarily attribute that too much to Joshua. I would say Moses had a tremendous amount of insight whenever he said to God, we need to appoint another leader who will come after me, because he understood the significance of that role. But we just see reiterated over and over and over in Scriptures the necessity of having good leaders in the home, of good leaders in the church. And if only we could have leaders that were like Moses and Joshua, then our country would no doubt be in a lot better shape. But the difference we can make is not in the big scheme of things. It's in our everyday life, the children that we raise, and our role as leaders in our home. And so the elders who survived Joshua, they helped the people remain faithful. And we come to verse 10. And verse 10 is one of the key passages that we mentioned at the beginning of the class. It's one of the ones in this chapter that stands out to us. And you see that all that generation also were gathered to their fathers. There arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord nor the work which he had done for Israel. My mom has said before, an observation I think she either made or heard in a lesson, it's the third generation that you've got to look out for. She said, how do parents know if they've done a good job in raising their children? They look at their grandchildren. There's that third generation, parent, child, grandchildren. You look at your grandchildren and their behavior, you're able to determine what, by and large, not always to be the case, because we understand everyone has the ability, although being brought up right, to go astray. But generally, if you look at the behavior of your grandchildren, you'll gauge somewhat your success as apparent. But it's this idea of being the third generation. Let me give you an example that I observed. A congregation that I attended in my past, whenever the grandmother, the matriarch, if you will, was alive, she had children. They came to church. She took them to church. She made them be there. In turn, they brought their children to church as well. Now, as long as that grandmother remained faithful, her children were there. Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, gospel meetings, singings, all of this, they were there. But she passed away. And what began to happen shortly after she passed away was the attendance and the faithfulness of her children gradually began to decrease. And more so, you see the effect even greater and even further with the grandchildren. And so there's just something about that third generation that is of the utmost importance. That's what we see here. This third generation arose that did not know God. So let's talk about that for just a moment. Question six that we have, and I hope to get some good discussion here from this question. Who was to be blamed for the wayward generation that arose? And why would you place the fault with them? Okay. Good point. Is that not scary, though? The fact that you and I can live good lives as parents, we can be faithful and pleasing to God, but we can raise children that aren't. That's scary. As a father, to me, the fact that I can't have any guarantee that the faithfulness that I have, is perhaps as small as it is not necessarily going to be inherited automatically by my children, that's scary to me. However, that brings to my attention this idea, the importance of my responsibility in bringing them up. And as Tommy said, as teaching them to know God. Miss Johnny? That's a good point. I think of that passage in Hebrews 11 where it says, Abel being dead yet speaketh. The things that we do on this earth after we're gone, they'll be carried forth and they'll be passed out into the world through our children. We need to think very carefully. What message are we sending? John? That's a good observation. We can understand the same logic as it's applied in the business world. If someone takes and builds a company from the ground up and they pour their blood, sweat, and tears into it, they go through that experience. And we're going to see something in chapter 3, an observation later, where God says the people need to be tested. This new generation needs to learn what it means to go to war. It's important that they not just receive all of the blessings given by God without having to work for them. And we're growing up. My generation, and maybe even the one before that, has this sense of entitlement, but they don't understand what it means, how I need to go about achieving this success, maintaining this success. And this generation that came along after Joshua, they didn't know how to handle that. But good observation, John, but it goes back to where every time? The parents' responsibility. Dave, were you going to say something?
Still have to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps.
ultimately, it comes down to me, right? And it goes both ways, as Dave is saying. Ultimately, I've got to be the one to make the decision. Parents may do things perfectly, and they may not only not just go through the motions, but they may be successful, and they may make every decision that they should raising their children. But at the end of the day, it's got to be the child that decides, I'm going to follow the Lord, and I've got to work out my own salvation. And although you look at this, and as we're going to read a few verses here in just a moment, perhaps they weren't raised with ideal circumstances. They could have still chose to do differently. They could have still chose to draw closer to God rather than pursuing idols. And at the end of the day, yes, their parents were to blame, but so were they. They were the ones that made the decision. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, everybody else was bowing down, but they made that decision themselves. Yeah. And it's got to come down to me making that. Your parents can't make that statement for you. Your grandparents can't make that statement for you. It's got to be a statement that you make for you and for your family, and then that each subsequent generation has got to make for themselves. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. I was going to have us... We got a few minutes to read a few of the passages. Let's go to Joshua chapter 4, since we're talking about Joshua a little bit. I was going to reference a passage in Leviticus chapter 10, verses 8 through 11. If you want to jot down Leviticus 10, 8 through 11, you see that God charges very specifically the Levites with the responsibility to be the teachers of God's people. They were God's inheritance. They were God's blessing. God was their portion. They didn't receive the same benefits and the same land promises and all of these things that all of the other tribes received, because they were going to give themselves to the very significant task of going through the portions of worship and the sacrifices and all of those things. But not only that, you go to Leviticus 10, 8 through 11, and you read, the priests were commanded to be teachers of the people. And it seems kind of obvious that they probably fell down in their duties on that, that teaching didn't take place as it should have. Joshua 4, verses 4 through 7. Dustin, do you have that? Could you read that for us? Mm-hmm. This is more, and if you're taking notes and you want to jot down Deuteronomy 6, 20 through 24, this kind of falls in the same vein as what we see Joshua commanding the people to do. When they crossed over the Jordan, they were to set these stones taken from the dry Jordan River, and they were to take this monument and place them all together. And one day the children were going to see that and say, "Hey, Dad, hey, Mom, what are these stones here for?" And they would tell them, and they would remind them about God, how He dried the Jordan River so that the people could cross, and He walked with them into the land of Canaan, and then He proceeded to give them that land. That was to remind them. Deuteronomy 6, 20 through 24, all of the feasts, all of the memorials, all of the festivals that God set up, the Passover, Pentecost, the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Booths, all of those various things that were performed throughout the year were so that the children of Israel would observe and remember what God had done for them. And so God wasn't going to leave these people with any excuse. He was going to make sure they were to be taught by God, by the priests, by their parents, by their families. We won't take the time to read this. We need to move on. Deuteronomy 6, 6 through 9, you know that passage, where God says that they were to take the word of God, and it was to be put as a frontlet between their eyes, and it was something that was constantly to be in front of them. He charges the parents with teaching their children as they sit down, as they walk by the way, as they lay down at night. God's word is to be ingrained and instilled within their minds. Dave?
Yeah,
And props to this generation. You know, they may have made some mistakes in teaching their children. I think that was definitely present. But at the same time, while they may not have verbally fulfilled all that God commanded them to do, their example, like you say, their example was stable. Their example was steady. If not by their words, then by their deeds at the least, this generation should have been able to look back and say, hey, mom and dad have been serving the Lord all their life and for good reason. And it should cause them to want to introspectively look at themselves and compare themselves and align themselves with what they had been raised to do, even though perhaps the words weren't said and the things weren't taught to them that should have been. They had their parents' example, because we read here, Joshua's generation and the people, the generation following and the people, they were faithful to God. And so if nothing else, they did have their parents' example. But then we see in Judges 2:10, this generation arose, and this phrase comes up. It says, they did not know God. Now you go over to 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 12. You remember Samuel's sons, two heathens, two Cretans. The same thing is said of them, that they did not know God. Now you'll remember Samuel, he was a priest. But it was said of his sons that they did not know God. How might that be? I'd suggest there is a difference between knowing God and knowing about God. This generation, they probably would have known that arose in 2:10 that didn't know God. They would have known about God. They would have celebrated the feast. They would have saw the memorial stones. They would have heard from their parents what God had done. And so it wasn't that they didn't know about God. It said that they did not know God. It's the difference between experiential and practical theoretical knowledge. You know, apparently, I've come to find out that my wife can make this wonderful casserole that I don't have any appreciation for. Now, maybe some of y'all didn't get to eat that, but you heard everybody ranting and raving about it. And I can tell you all day long how wonderful this casserole is that Whitney makes. You've only got a theoretical knowledge. You've not eaten it. You've not tasted it. You don't understand. You can't put any flavor to it, as I talk about. You can just hear and understand, okay, this is wonderful. Versus the person who may have eaten it and enjoyed it, they can understand in a different sense because they have experienced the taste of it. And the difference is between knowing God and knowing about God. Knowing about God is the theoretical knowledge that parents instill within their children. But it gets to a point, as David said, you got to taste and see that the Lord is good. You can't just base your faith off what you've been taught. At some point in time, you have to experience God. And that's what it means. These people knew about God. I would dare say that they didn't. They would have heard the stories. They would have seen the festivals. But they did not taste and see that the Lord is good. And they did not have the appreciation that their parents did for God. They did not know Him. Any comments on that, John? Well, two generations later.
Yeah, two.
Right. You're saying exactly right. You're saying the exact same thing Dave did. Now, I will say, it's like this. At the end of the day, as both John and Dave have reiterated, I have got to be the one to make that decision. But how much easier is it for me to make that decision if, when I look at mom and dad, they're the example that I need to follow? If whenever I was being brought up, they instructed me and told me about God, they taught me God's word, they took me to church, they showed me how to behave, and they made me do all of these things. Okay, it's much easier for me to then fall in step with what God has commanded because I have been instructed and circumstances have taken and molded me so that I have the best possible chance to follow God. But at the same time, you can have a person that wasn't raised going to church and that wasn't brought up by godly parents. In fact, their parents may have been the very antithesis of what a Christian was supposed to be. And at some point in time in their life, they may come to that point of obedience. Okay, you've got both people who are on the right track, but I am going to have a significantly better chance if the circumstances occur that help bring me in line with God. But at the end of the day, in both instances, I've got to be the one to make that decision. And what I'm saying for parents, for grandparents, for me, and as I raise my children, we need to be doing our dead level best to give our children the best chance that they can. Sure, they got to make that choice at the end of the day, but let's not say that if they go astray, it wasn't because of anything I did, or it wasn't because of anything that I neglected to do. I did everything that I could to give them the best chance they needed to serve the Lord, and at the end of the day, they just simply did not make that decision themselves. But good observation. I appreciate everyone's comments on all of those. Let's look real quickly at question 7. It'll probably end with this. It only takes one generation. The scary thought. It only takes one generation. What can Christian parents do for their children, and I'm talking about in today's time, to help guard against apostasy? And as I've said, this is something I think about a lot as a new parent. It's something that's very fearful to me as I've witnessed good people that I've known raising children, and some successful, some more so failing, though. And so it's very disconcerting to me. And so I hope to be able to benefit a little bit from some of the wisdom from those who are here and that have raised children and see the good and the bad. What are some things Christian parents can do for their children to help guard against apostasy? Actions speak louder than words. That's a good point. Dave? A lot of people see God as restrictive. We've got to understand that the things that God speaks and commands and restricts, they come from a God that loves us and that tries to protect us. Good observation, and we need to allow that to trickle down in the life of our children. Miss Johnny? Can you expound on that idea? How might one go about earning the respect of their children? I suppose you can apply all the love that you want as you bring your children up, but if they don't respect you, then it doesn't really matter at the end of the day, does it? Good point. So we've got to earn our children's respect through obedience, through compassion, through unconditional love. So, Tommy? Okay, discipline, the very core and heart of discipline better be love. If it's not, then it's abuse. Dave?
Just
there is a sense of duty to it. You already mentioned at the core of that is love, but there is at the same time a sense of duty. And I think when you think, and that, I think that's a good approach to have. You got too many parents that are trying to raise their children by being their friend, being the cool parent. And when you're the cool parent, when you're the friend of the child, then you can't really make some of those hard decisions that need to be made that Dave talked about. You know, foolishness is bound up in the heart of the child. The rod of correction drives it far from them. It's hard to be a child's friend and then take the appropriate disciplinary action whenever the situation calls for it. And so this idea of approaching it, as Dave described, as being a sense of duty, that places within us a sense of urgency in the way that we raise our children. And so that's it's a good way to think about it. It's tough, I'm sure, sometimes because, I can look at my life and I can see that if I looked at that as my duty, there have been times I failed in my duty. And I imagine every parent that's raised children could say, as they look back at their life, if they analyze the things that they've done, then they too have failed in their duty. But the only thing that we can do moving forward is try to do the best we can. It's a good observation. Anyone else? Dave? Amen. Proverbs 22:6 just left me. Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. I mean, that's not by any means a general rule, but if you do your job as a parent, those seeds are planted, and they'll remember. And though they make decisions that the way you brought them up is constantly going to be in the back of their mind, and hopefully, as you pray and as you wait, at some point in time, those things will come back to the forefront, and they'll remember their upbringing and your teaching as a child. So most definitely very good observation. Well, I think, Buster?
When you teach your son or your daughter, you're also teaching your potential grandson.
That's a good way to think about it. You know, we sang that song, Dick led that song, The Apples and the Seed, and that kind of, I think, demonstrates that, because the way you bring them up, they're going to follow in your footsteps, and they're probably going to raise their children in a very similar fashion to the way that you did. And so to know that you had a hand in that, that's powerful. Good observation. All right, I thank everybody for their participation in our class this morning. We're going to try our best to finish up next week verses 11 through the rest of the chapter, which is verse 27. I know that's a lot of content, but I think we'll be able to do that. So I thank everybody for their sharing their observations and their comments with us in our class this morning.